United States v. Kenneth Barnett. Let's see, Ms. Mullen.
May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. The government's position in this case boils down to this. While the district court properly found that the officers here had reasonable suspicion that Mr. Barnett had burglarized the nearby restaurant, it then failed to appreciate the legal and logical consequences of that ruling. The Supreme Court in Terry v. Ohio made it clear that sometimes it is the nature of the offense itself that the officers are investigating that gives rise to the automatic right to frisk. In Terry, of course, the offense that was being investigated was a suspected daytime robbery. Here we have a suspected nighttime burglary.
Now, Ms. Mullen, assuming that the officers have reasonable basis to frisk at the outset of a Terry encounter, might the passage of time eliminate that basis if the officers delay the frisk?
It could, Your Honor, if during the time that there is a delay, the basis for the stop, the reasonable suspicion for the stop, evaporates. That's not what happened here. In fact, the district court specifically found here that the anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes that the officers were talking to Mr. Barnett, that the reasonable suspicion that he had burglarized the nearby restaurant did not evaporate or even dissipate at all. That in fact what the officers learned during that time would have led to more reasonable suspicion that he had burglarized the building. So in answer to your question, certainly it could happen. It didn't happen in this particular case.
If the basis for the frisk is the safety of the officers, wouldn't we expect officers to frisk at the outset rather than delaying?
I think that it depends. Even in Terry, the majority opinion at the end of the opinion suggested that it might be appropriate in most cases for the officer to go up, introduce himself or identify himself, and ask a couple of questions to see if he could very quickly discern what was going on and have that suspicion dispelled. Also, officers on the scene, of course, want to get a bead on a situation, want to get a read from the person they're encountering, oftentimes before they decide to frisk. In this particular case, the officers actually called for backup before they frisked Mr. Barnett. And the district court asked them, interrupted the testimony to ask the officer testifying, well, why did you do that? Two of you were there. There's only one suspect here. No one else was around. The officer said, Your Honor, Mr. Barnett's a quite large man. It was a dark parking lot. We suspected that he had a weapon, and we've been trained that when we suspect that someone has a weapon, it's better safe than sorry. It's always better to get an additional officer on the scene. Amen. To make sure that we can control the situation.
Between the time the first, as I understand it, there was a first after the discussion and whatever the preliminary stuff, then he did indicate, I forget the officer's name, younger one.
Sinks, Officer Sinks.
He was, he said he was going to have to frisk you. And then Barnett says that, well, no, you can't because my attorney says I don't have to or can't be frisked or something like that.
That's right. That is what he said in response. He said, I don't want you to frisk me. My attorney has advised me not to let officers frisk me in these situations. The district court found that that response was a response that would have put the officers on further alert that something might be awry here and would have added, again, to their reasonable suspicion that something amiss was going on.
I don't know. I guess Sink backed off until the backup showed up. Is that right?
That's right. They immediately called for backup. Once Sinks determined that he was going to frisk Mr. Barnett, they called for backup. There was another officer in the area who responded almost immediately, and at that point they frisked Mr. Barnett.
At that point, then they said, all right, now we're going to frisk you. And then that's when he said, well, all right, I got the gun. Because I'm curious about the I don't know what I would call it, the dissipation or the reduction of the reasonable suspicion that the court determined.
The court, it's really important that this court understand that the district court did not find that the reasonable suspicion for the stop dissipated. In other words, did not find that reasonable suspicion that Mr. Barnett had burglarized the building had dissipated, only that their fear for their safety dissipated. The district court mistakenly thought that the officers had to have some sort of additional information above and beyond the fact that they were investigating the suspected burglary in order to frisk Mr. Barnett. and the district court focused on cases out of this circuit where the officers did have additional information. Those were cases, though, where the nature of the crime itself would not have led to the automatic right to frisk. The courts make a distinction, of course, between cases like or crimes like robbery, burglary, rape, murder, large amounts of narcotics, where there is this automatic right to frisk because a reasonably prudent man in those circumstances would believe that the suspect he's investigating is likely armed or dangerous. And those cases, underage drinking, curfew offenses, minor traffic offenses, prostitution, where they wouldn't necessarily have a reasonable belief that someone committing that type of crime would have a weapon. And so I think the error in the district court's analysis here was in believing that the officers here had to, A, have a subjective fear for their safety, which we know this court and the Supreme Court in cases like Wren has repeatedly said is not necessary. That was the first part of the error. And the second was in thinking that the officers had to have some additional information, a tip that there had been a robbery or that Mr. Barnett had to behave in a specific way during that initial brief encounter to have aroused their suspicions and believe them, and cause them to believe to fear for their safety. So,
what about, you mentioned the subjective, I assume you're referring to what the impression of a gun that the court later determined couldn't be possible because of the oversized whatever outfit he had on.
Well, the court also pointed to the fact that I believe it was Officer Sinks who said, until I saw the outline of a gun, I didn't believe or think that Mr. Barnett was armed. And yes, the district court did eventually discredit the officer's testimony, both of their testimony that they saw the outline of a gun. In doing so, the district court said it's certainly possible that they saw the outline of a gun, but because of the additional testimony adduced at the supplemental hearings, the government has no longer met their burden of demonstrating that by a preponderance of the evidence. Again, though, in doing that, the district court was careful not to discredit the rest of the officer's testimony. Before the district court issued its lengthy, very thorough written ruling, it ordered up the transcripts of all three of the suppression hearings, the initial one and the two supplementals, reviewed those, and in the written order granting the motion to suppress, credited the officer's testimony, again found the reasonable suspicion for the stop. And again, in denying the government's motion to reconsider, the same thing. The district court never went back and discredited any other portion of the officer's testimony. And whether or not they saw the outline of a gun, it's our position, is legally irrelevant to the analysis. That accepting all of the facts as the district court found them, this is a purely legal argument that we're making today. We're not quibbling with any of the district court's factual findings. And again, our very simple argument is because the officers had reasonable suspicion that Mr. Barnett had burglarized the building, that fact in and of itself justified the frisk in this case, and that's the lesson of Terry.
Passed through the frisk and the discovery of the weapon, or actually the discovery of the weapon, because they didn't have to frisk and get it. Did anything occur after that as far as checking the keys and whether they worked and whether he really worked there? And whether
the officers were asked at the hearing, Your Honor, whether or not they were able to discern whether the building had in fact been burglarized, and they said it had not been burglarized. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that Mr. Barnett wasn't contemplating.
Well, no, I would. He had a set of keys, which I'm curious, did anybody check to see if they actually didn't open or close the building?
No, no one checked to see whether the keys actually opened or closed the building. And, of course, at the time that the officers are discussing this with them, Mr. Barnett comes up with this story. The district court found that the story that he came up with about closing the restaurant and walking home to a local address a few blocks away didn't square with his identification and certainly didn't square with his behavior. And so, as the district court found, the officers right away would have found that story suspect in the context of everything that was going on. Thank you.
Mr. Kelly?
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, I'm compelled to say that I believe that counsel has misstated the evidence. I was there through it all. I believe that the police officers were thoroughly discredited by virtue of the demonstration that showed it was totally impossible for them to have seen a bulge, seen a gun, as they had initially testified to, and which was the basis of the court's original ruling denying my motion to suppress. So when this demonstration took place, the best way I can say it is that the officers were thoroughly discredited. They were not investigating a suspected burglary, as counsel has just told you. They testified, Officer Sinks testified, that he saw this man in the shadows of the restaurant where he worked. He was walking across a gas station parking lot, and that he stopped him on a hunch that there might be something amiss. There was never any testimony about there had been a burglary, or even initially that there was a burglary. So they were not investigating a burglary. They stopped him thinking he might have been up to who knows what. They never explained that. But it seems to me, Your Honor, that if we go back to Terry, the basis for your decision in this case is really found in Justice Warren's statement of what the holding is in Terry. And he said that when a police officer observes unusual conduct that leads him to reasonably conclude that criminal activity may be afoot, and that the persons that he is dealing with might be armed and presently dangerous, and where he identifies himself as a policeman and makes a reasonable inquiry, and all that happened here. But here's the important thing that's been left out through all the briefs and the argument. Justice Warren says, and where nothing in the initial stages of the encounter serves to dispel his reasonable fear for his own or others' safety, then he may take on the search, the pat-down, to look for weapons. Here we had an initial encounter of up to 5 minutes by the officer's testimony, in which they asked this man his name. He showed him the keys. He said, I just got off work. I just locked up the business. He told them where he'd been. He told them where he was going. He produced his identification. They testified he was cordial. He was cooperative. He was friendly, albeit he was nervous. He was sweating because the squad car had just come up within 5 to 10 feet of him, stopped, and two officers got out. We would all be nervous. So I would say, put ourselves in these shoes. There was an initial encounter here which dispelled any fear that these officers had, which dispelled any need they would have had to conduct a search and violate this man's Fourth Amendment rights. So I think this case before us is four square with the holding in Terry. The second part of the holding, which is in the initial stages of the encounter, dispelled any fear that these officers had. No. There's nothing in this record that any of these two officers, either one of them, said they had suffered any fear. In fact, they testified.
They don't have to.
I'm sorry?
They don't have to be afraid.
And it's an objective test, and I agree with that, Your Honor. But I would say, and that would lead me to my next point, is that in looking at the objective facts and circumstances, and looking at it from an objective viewpoint, the two most important factors, it seems to me, are the time between the initial confrontation and the search. That's the most important factor. They couldn't have been very afraid when they talked to him for 5 minutes and then decided that they would do a pat-down search before they would let him leave.
Now, Judgment himself seemed to agree that the officers could have frisked him down at the outset of this encounter. If so, why would the five-minute delay matter?
Well, because of the, Your Honor, the questioning. If this was yourself walking down the street, or if it was me walking down the street and we were accosted by a police officer and asked these questions, and I would like to use this example. Suppose that the person walking up and down looking in the window in Terry, when he was accosted, instead of mumbling something immediately, what if he'd said, I'm a window washer, and I've got to make a bid on washing these windows tomorrow, so I'm trying to get a mental picture of how many square feet I've got here. If he would have said that, we wouldn't have had the Terry decision.
No, maybe we wouldn't.
Well.
Yeah, it's dark at night. It's, yeah. You know, here's
10 o'clock at night.
This person sort of wandering around, you know, wearing a size 500 sweatsuit.
Well, we do have, and the second factor is what were the actions and statements of the police officers themselves? Neither one were afraid. Neither one suspected that he did have a gun.
That isn't quite true. They see either one of us afraid, I'll say that may be true, but that's because they're such fearless folk, police officers. But they didn't. They frisked him because they thought he might have a gun.
Well,
what's interesting to me is they asked him, could they frisk him, which is kind of fascinating.
I mean, and Your Honor, you know, there's a fine line between good police work,
yep,
and harassment, racial profiling.
Yeah, well, that's not an element in this. Don't raise that one. I mean,
well, I'm just saying that sometimes policemen try to justify what they've done when they're fishing.
Sometimes criminals do exactly the same thing, but
I agree.
That's not the issue here. We have a plain record before us, and that's
right.
The predicate for our decisions.
Right, yeah. Right. Now, I would ask the court to consider the fact that the defendant here, his credibility was never questioned by the court.
He said he had the gun. That made it very credible.
Well, he had the gun, but I don't think in the context of your decision here you can look into his criminal background. Nothing was known of him by these two officers at the time of the stop. So I think he has the right of any citizen to be walking down the street at 10 o'clock at night and not be accosted by the police and be searched unless there's a legitimate basis for it. I think that this is an example of what Justice Warren was talking about in Terry, that if we're going to erode Fourth Amendment rights in this Terry context, they has to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
Well, the other side of it is, are we going to erode Terry? Because this period of time that they're conversing and just being a little more casual about it, and this guy's got this oversized suit on, I'm not sure what that would alert to one way or the other. But then he did get to the point where he said, I guess, asking to frisk, and then the guy says, whatever she quoted it before, about now I'm my lawyer tells me don't frisk or don't get frisked or I don't have to be frisked or something, which gives a little different indication about what his own background is and why this reasonable suspicion may continue. Now, maybe that's not fair to get to that point. I guess you would say maybe before then he shouldn't have been able to ask. I guess that would be your conclusion.
Well, I think that's
otherwise, so once he says that, that's another alert, and then the other police officer comes up, and then they say, we're going to frisk you. So I guess that's where we're looking at it. The gun notwithstanding, or the image of the gun, or the oversized clothes and all that.
I think Judge Mim took a long time, did a lot of research, wrote a well-reasoned opinion.
That he wanted it reviewed.
and asked this court to review it, and I think he was right, and I would hope Your Honors agree.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Mullen, I think you have a little time left. Yeah, you got a minute left.
Thank you. I have just a few brief points. One, I do want to touch on the district court's factual findings one more time. The reason that we know that the district court credited the officer's testimony is because, other than the very brief testimony by Mr. Barnett, that's all the testimony that there was. And in the district court's factual findings, the district court clearly adopts the facts as testified to by the officers. The court also did find Mr. Barnett incredible with respect to one part of his testimony, and that's that he hadn't lost any weight, because the objective evidence demonstrated that he had lost at least 34 pounds from the time of his arrest, the night of his arrest, until the time he was weighed a week before the hearing. So that is one point in which the district court found Mr. Barnett incredible. I think, again, the most important thing to focus on here is when we're talking about the right to frisk dissipating, that is directly connected to the reasonable suspicion for the stop, not something happening during that the course of the 5 minutes to make the officers fear more or less for their safety. It was the stop itself on suspicion of burglary that created that automatic right to frisk, and that did not go away during that 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks. This case will be taken under advisement, and Mr. Kelly, I understand you were court-appointed, and you've obviously done good work for your client, and we thank you for that.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, this case will be taken under advisement.